From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now! Republicans vote for House Speaker. We'll look at money and politics from Congress to the White House. The Supreme Court hears oral arguments in the case of a judge who sexually assaulted five women. And the AFL-CIO responds to proposals to privatize Social Security.
We know when we feel someone's hand in our pocket that we are probably getting our pocket picked. And so we will begin today to form a powerful coalition to dispatch this twin-headed monster supported by Wall Street and right-wing think tanks so we can get on with the business of stabilizing Social Security.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Although Newt Gingrich has admitted ethics violations, House Republican leaders say he'll win re-election today to a second term as House Speaker. But the potential defection of some rank-and-file Republicans has left enough doubt that GOP leaders are planning to lobby members until the roll is called. At least five Republicans say they won't vote for Gingrich today. One of them is Banking Committee Chair Jim Leach, who says Gingrich is, in his words, ethically damaged. Another is Washington Republican Congressmember Linda Smith.
That when we have the ethics vote, though, given the information I've read, and I have read it all, I used to teach tax law changes to people that prepared tax returns. I do not believe it is strong with what I've read thus far.
Yeah.
I do not believe, actually, that this man would get very much of even a slap on the wrist with what I've seen thus far. But I have not been able to see everything. I'm told in 2 weeks I get to see the rest of it. If what I've seen is no more than what is there, I might not vote for him any more than a light reprimand. But that is not the issue. Newt Gingrich started the term with a $4 million contract that brought down the confidence of the American people, not just in him, but this body, and in me as a leader. Now what we're up against is a history, then, of even where he sits on the plane.
And now win or lose, Gingrich still faces punishment from the Ethics Committee and a public hearing. The Presidential Advisory Committee on Gulf War Veterans Illnesses is presenting President Clinton its final report today, but it's not expected to resolve the mystery of the cause of the health problems. The panel has agreed that the variety of symptoms are not caused by one single agent, such as chemical weapons. Also, commissioners suggest the stress of war may be responsible for real physical problems of some of the veterans. The U.S. Supreme Court has rejected a white supremacist group's challenge to a city's parade ban. The group wanted to have a morning parade in Cumming, Georgia, protesting the Martin Luther King holiday, but the city does not allow demonstrations before 1 p.m. Also yesterday, the Supreme Court ruled that federal judges imposing sentence on convicted defendants may, and in many circumstances must, take into account not only the crimes of which defendants were convicted, but also additional charges of which juries found them not guilty. And another Supreme Court case that will be taken up today by the Supreme Court, the question of whether the Constitution protects against sexual assault. Justices will hear arguments in the case involving a former Tennessee judge. David Lanier was convicted of sexually assaulting five women who either had legal matters in his court or were his employees. We'll have more on that story later in the show. The Citadel has plans to offer a federal judge evidence of its efforts to ensure the safety of female cadets. The South Carolina Military College also plans to explain how it tried to prevent abuse and hazing, as alleged by two of the four women in the cadet corps. This international news, a Palestinian negotiator has rejected a proposal by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that Israel's last withdrawal in the West Bank be put off until May of 1999. A timetable for a series of troop withdrawals from the West Bank is the main issue holding up an Israeli pullout from 80% of Hebron, the last Palestinian city under Israeli control. A bomb blew up a Nigerian army bus outside a military camp in Lagos today, killing at least one soldier and wounding 15 people, the third bombing against army targets in politically troubled Nigeria since December. Two bombs have exploded within days last month, clearly targeting the military administrator of Lagos State, a close aide of military ruler General Sani Abacha. So far, no one's claimed responsibility for the recent wave of bomb blasts, but police say a bungled car bomb explosion in November that killed three people was the work of agents of exiled opposition leader Wole Soyinka. Wole Soyinka was on Democracy Now! Just a month ago. He has vehemently denied any involvement, but has refused to condemn the attacks. Meanwhile, according to a report by the World Council of Churches, years of oil spills and political repression have devastated the Ogoni region of southern Nigeria. The organization, which has 330 member churches in more than 100 countries, accused the oil company Shell of destroying the livelihoods of many Ogonis and leaving the environment a mess. And finally, South Korean President Kim Jong-sam has made clear he will not surrender to strikers and scrap a new labor law, angering unions that vowed to step up industrial action engulfing the economy. State prosecutors, meanwhile, are poised to issue arrest warrants against militant union leaders who've defied orders to appear for questioning over nationwide strikes that have been declared illegal. At a news conference, Kim insisted the new bill, which shatters near-total job security by allowing worker layoffs, would strengthen South Korea's sagging economy. And you're listening to Democracy Now! The new Congress convenes today, with 74 new members in the House and 15 in the Senate being formally sworn in. Immediately after the swearing-in ceremony, House members will cast their votes for House Speaker. Candidates spent a record $660 million to win congressional seats this past election year. Deep-pocket candidates included House Speaker Newt Gingrich, who ran the costliest campaign of any House representative, spending about $5.5 million for his Georgia seat. Overall, Republican candidates narrowly outspent Democrats, and incumbents outspent challengers by a huge margin. What does all this money mean for the next 105th Congress? We're now joined by Charles Lewis of the Washington, D.C.-based Center for Public Integrity. Why don't we begin with House Speaker Newt Gingrich, since money is intimately tied to his ethics violations?
Well, we have a person here who has used money to achieve power for the last 20 years, and the charges against him that we're hearing about this week are surrounding the use of money involving tax-exempt charities and commingling it with campaign money and campaign committees, and basically coming close, if not violating, tax laws in this country. He also raised more money and spent more money than any other member of Congress this past session. And so, and actually, there was a report over the weekend that the incoming and outgoing heads of the Republican Campaign Committee in the House of Representatives were leaning on Ethics Committee members to send a letter out last week saying that everything was peachy and that, you know, this thing was not a problem and everyone should therefore vote to reelect Newt Gingrich as Speaker. And the reason that's significant is the threat of campaign cash for the next cycle, for 97-98, it was being held over many members' head and is being held over their head as a blunt instrument. And so money, 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 it has become an issue. It has been an issue in his career. It remains an issue in his career. And I don't see any contrition or any signs that it's going to change in terms of relationship to his career.
Well, I want to talk about campaign finance reform, but some interesting statistics have come out from the Federal Election Committee. As you said, Newt Gingrich spent the most as a candidate for Congress, $5.5 million, followed by Michael Coles, the man who ran against him. Then Richard Gephardt is number three with close to $3 million, beating his challenger. Ellen Tauscher, 2.5 million dollars, and then it goes down from there. And on the Senate end of things, Mark Warner, who lost the campaign in Virginia, he spent $11.5 million, followed by John Kerry, who won, the Democrat of Massachusetts, $10.5 million. Guy Milner, the Republican of Georgia, who lost to Max Cleland, $9.1 million. And Robert Torricelli, the Democrat of New Jersey, who beat Dick Zimmer for an open seat, spent more than $9 million. What is the answer? What is the campaign finance reform package that you would support?
Well, at the Center for Public Integrity, we don't endorse specific legislative initiatives or take a position on legislation. But as you know, in 96, there were 55 bills introduced, everything from full public financing to free broadcast time to ending soft money to raising the amounts of money. You name it, everyone has a reform proposal. I mean, I think you clearly have a situation that's out of control here. When the average House seat is over $600,000 and the average Senate seat is over $4.5 million, and these averages have just risen substantially in the 96 election, the average person and even an outstanding person in a local community that wants to run for office simply won't do it. We found at the presidential level when we did the Buying of the President book that there were several candidates, including Colin Powell and Dick Cheney and Bill Bennett, former cabinet officers, could not raise enough to run for president. They needed $20 million. But I'm talking just for a House race in some community in America. You're going to have to go out and raise $500,000 or more, and that doesn't come from bake sales or backyard barbecues. So we have a crisis in our democracy. There are certain people that can run and that are willing to raise money from people that we don't want to spend any time with, or they're millionaires themselves, and they're spending $10 million out of their bank account. And so that's where we are today in this country.
What would public financing mean of a campaign, and what is your assessment of the McCain-Feingold bill?
Well, public financing would be an issue as long as you have the Supreme Court ruling Buckley versus Valeo from 1976, as long as the court seems to be saying that how much money you spend is an issue of free speech, if you have public financing, it's going to be voluntary. That means that taxpayer money will be given to people who agree to play by the rules, but if you want to spend your own money, you can do that too. And so it's always going to be, I jokingly refer to it as the carrot and the stick, but there's no stick because the Federal Election Commission is basically toothless and ineffectual. The problem, McCain-Feingold is a pale imitation even of that. I mean, there are state initiatives such as in Maine and other parts of the country where there is now voluntary public financing, where public funds are being given to candidates and an attempt to drive out all private money, which is a way to clean things up. There are problems with public financing, which we could talk about at great length. It's not a panacea, but it is an attempt to change the landscape.
Why isn't it a panacea?
Well, the critics of it say that it would only help incumbents remain in power, and that how do you achieve thresholds? How do you decide who to give money to? And isn't money needed at the very onset for any candidacy? And how do you determine?
If you give equal amounts to an incumbent and the person challenging the incumbent absolutely
right.
has the lead because they have name recognition.
Exactly. In the House of Representatives in a 96 race, most of the victors, there's news stories that are going to come out in the next several days. The average amount for a House seat usually is about $600,000, but for challengers, it was over $800,000, and for successful challengers, it was over $1 million. So usually, you do have to raise more money and spend more money. Now, switching to McCain-Feingold, the one measure of the 55 that had the most bipartisan support, there's good news and bad news here. The good news is that Republicans and Democrats never agree on this, and there are some ranging from, various people in the Congress, but also Ross Perot and Bill Clinton have all endorsed this bill. And that's unusual in the 20-year history of campaign finance reform. In fact, that never happens. The bad news is, or the frustrating part is, it's really only a first step or a compromise measure. For example, millionaires can still give money, but in California, instead of Huffington giving $28 million, he can only give $5 million. That's still a lot of money. So, I mean, it is a first step, and it's an interesting attempt, and it may even be unconstitutional. No one knows how it'll hold up against the various recent court rulings. You have broadcast time. That's exciting. I think a lot of people understand and recognize that the airwaves belong to the public.
But it doesn't seem that the people who own the networks understand that.
No, I don't think they do understand that, or they certainly don't want to discuss it.
Explain what you mean, though, because I don't think most people understand that it's the people who own the airwaves.
Well, in any country today, most countries around the world, just by way of comparison, sometimes we learn more about our culture by going outside the U.S. The airwaves are a precious finite commodity, and there are only so many broadcast bands and wavelengths that are available in any country, and they are monitored and regulated by the government, which represents the people. And and that can be a problem of oppression in many states and nation states, because if you're not saying the right thing, you don't get a radio station, et cetera. But the bottom line is, it's not like newspapers where anyone can just do a newspaper. It is not the same thing in a media context. And so anyway, what's happening in this country, and I'm not an expert on this, but this concept of the public owning the airwaves is kind of sliding back. The Telecommunications Act of the past year that passed, which is historic, basically throws it open to the market, and the public has very little redress or recourse against the large media conglomerates. And the reason this is relevant in a campaign finance context is, now we have 10-second sound bites and negative campaigning and all these things, and there is no way for any reasonable discourse to occur on our airwaves. And so there are a lot of people who think that, therefore, there should be free broadcast time, lots of debates, those kinds of things. And the networks have sort of dragged their feet on this, understandably. It would cut into their sitcoms and other things that are bringing in huge sums of money. And so the McCain-Feingold bill has a measure in there that in the waning days of a campaign would mandate airtime for candidates. That's the good news. The bad news is it's a minuscule amount of airtime. It's almost non-existent. I mean, in terms of the amount, it's not a radical draconian thing that they're imposing on TV stations, for example, around the nation. So it's one of those things where it's got some interesting thoughts. It's even got some creativity to it, but it's not a panacea.
We're talking to Charles Lewis, who is head of the Center for Public Integrity that's based here in Washington, D.C., that's known for putting out all sorts of reports from the torturers' lobby, those that lobby Congress representing military regimes and dictators around the world, to the report on gambling in politics. Well, I wanted to turn from money in Congress to money in the White House. We know that there are going to be hearings held on President Clinton's campaign finances, and many are clear that the reason he supported McCain-Feingold has come out on that is he's trying to get around what has happened in his campaign. It's not only Newt Gingrich. You did a study on the Lincoln bedroom.
Right. We released it in August, actually the day before the Democratic convention. And we found that 75 donors to the Democratic Party or to Bill Clinton slept in the Lincoln bedroom. And that was just an isolated period that we'd looked at. Actually, it was mostly 93 with a spillover into 94, 95. But the Lincoln bedroom and other rooms in the White House are one element in a whole series of perks that fat cat donors get. And actually, the study was called Fat Cat Hotel. And there have been subsequent stories in the Washington Post and other places talking about this phenomenon. Clinton is not the first president to use the White House, but he seems to have done it more elaborately and more extensively than any recent president. And what makes Clinton different on all of this reform stuff is that he talks about reform. He feels our pain about the process being corrupt. But then a few hours later, he asks the same people that he complains about and we all complain about in terms of the special interests. He asks them for money, and he has raised unprecedented sums, tens and tens of millions of dollars. And so the Lincoln bedroom, in a way, is a symbol. Most Americans don't meet their elected officials. Most Americans don't go to the White House, and they surely don't go to the family quarters. And
most Americans don't sleep with the president.
Yeah, exactly.
Though maybe the president would like that to be otherwise.
Yeah. Right. So anyway, that's what we did. And I think that we're seeing all kinds of examples. I mean, when Indonesian billionaires come in and out of the White House 20 times, this is astounding stuff that's come out. I mean, if you did a movie, people wouldn't believe this. The revelations from Buddhist temples to Colombian drug traffickers to all kinds of people passing in and out of the White House, as long as they have cash and they give to the party. Chinese arms dealers. And so I think 97 and 98 is going to be a very grim period. We're talking at four congressional committees. You're talking about the prospect of indictments with Whitewater. I mean, it's going to be a very grim time in this town.
Speaking of money, and we do have to wrap up, I know you're just doing a study now on Cuban-American money. Any final comments on that?
Well, money extends to all elements of our society, and foreign policy is not exempt from that influence. And, you know, and in the coming weeks, we're going to put a study out that looks at the U.S. policy towards Cuba over the last, actually the last 30 or 40 years, and tries to put in context about logic and symmetry and do things like money and other forces influence the policy in an inordinate, distorted way. And So that'll be our latest, and we have other things coming behind that.
Well, we're going to have you back when that report comes out. Charles Lewis of the Center for Public Integrity. Your website, in case people want to travel over?
Yeah, we do have a website.
Is it CPI?
Yeah, it's www.essential.org/CPI.
That's www.essential.org/CPI. Right. Well, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Next up, we're going to take a look at a case that the Supreme Court is taking up today, and then the AFL-CIO responds to the panel dealing with Social Security. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. Listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers, I'm Amy Goodman. 4 years ago, Judge David Lanier was convicted of raping or sexually assaulting five women behind the walls of his brown-bricked and white-pillared West Tennessee courthouse. Dubbed a sexual predator in a judge's robe, Lanier was sentenced to 25 years in prison. But unusually, Lanier was tried on a Reconstruction-era federal statute that originally was used to protect the rights of African Americans against brutal local government officials. A federal appeals court threw out the conviction, saying it was never intended to protect women from sexual assaults. Today, as the case goes before the Supreme Court, we discuss some of the unique political and legal issues around this story. Our guest, Lorraine Dusky, who is a journalist and author of a new book called Still Unequal, The Shameful Truth About Women and Justice in America. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Lorraine.
Thank you.
Well, why don't you explain the facts around this case of Judge David Lanier?
I think it's important to understand that how powerful Lanier was in Western Tennessee to make people see how he could have so much power over these women and how they had no one to complain to. He came from a political dynasty that had been in power in Western Tennessee for decades because his father had been a political boss in two counties there. He himself had been the mayor of Dyersburg for 14 years, which is the town in which this occurred, and his brother was the DA, so there really was no one to complain to. He was the Chancery Court judge, which gave him more or less absolute power over divorces, bounty disputes, child custody and support cases. And furthermore, he hired and fired all of the people who worked at the court. And in Dyersburg, working at the court was one of the few good jobs for women who didn't have a college degree. And he and his brother were being investigated by the U.S. Justice Department for possible corruption when they began hearing the stories of the women about how he had been sexually harassing them in chambers, both women who worked for him and the women who came before him in, say, child custody cases. He threatened to take away one woman's child and transfer custody to her father if she didn't get a job, and then he sexually forced himself on her. He opened her pried open her jaw, put his penis in, and then moved her head up and down. And she got away that day, and then he said, you know, that he was going to transfer custody to her father unless she got a job. He later called her at home. She was living with her parents and told her mother that she needed to come back to the courthouse if she wanted, he could tell her about a job. And he did the same thing when she went back. I mean, that's only one case, there are other women testified before the Justice Department. The 19 women in all testified at the grand jury about grabbing breasts and buttocks and touching one woman generally during a hearing when they were out of view, and when she started to protest, he said, "Don't worry, I'm the judge. They can't do anything." And he was found guilty, but when they overturned his case, when the Sixth Circuit overturned it, they said that the right to be free from sexual assault, since it was not specifically listed in the law when it was written in the Reconstruction era, it didn't apply.
Huh. Explain the whole notion of color of law and this Reconstruction era law that this was brought under. For example, why wasn't Judge Lanier just tried for sexual assault and rape?
Well, because he would have to be tried in the state courts, and it was assumed, probably rightly, that it would never happen. Huh. That his family had too much power, he had too many friends. The Justice Department believed it would not happen if it was just left to the state of Tennessee to do it, and that's why it had to be brought under a federal statute. And so that's how they proceeded. The color of law means that he was acting as a judge and abusing his power. Most of these actions were done in chambers. They weren't done when and sometimes he had his robe on. So, or if you were going to see him on a matter that he was going to decide, he had the power. I mean, he was going to take your child away. He was going to go after your husband for child support, or he wasn't. He was going to give you the job, or he wasn't. He was acting officially. He was just as the policemen who beat up Rodney King were acting officially when they used their nightsticks on him. And in recent years, the case has been used many times in federal courts. Has been used many times in federal courts for a variety of different kinds of things, such as when a public official withholds money from a police chief to pay back a personal debt, or when a police officer claims to have special authority to assault his former wife's lover, or like I said about Rodney King, when a person's hit over the head with a nightstick. I mean, these are all people either acting officially or pretending, or acting officially with their robes on.
So why, or without their robes on, whatever the case may be, why don't women fall under this category?
Well, when the law was written, sexual assault was not specifically included, but neither were any of these other things which I mentioned. It just said that people should be free from harm and harassment from public officials. So Sixth Circuit said that since sexual assault was not included when the law was written, it doesn't apply. And if the Supreme Court wants it to apply, they need to say so. No one really has a clear idea of how this is going to go, because although conservatives seem to have been on the against Lanier, that what he did was so reprehensible it needs to be punished, there is some thought that since the language includes the right to bodily integrity, that conservatives will shy away from that because it sounds like it's giving women an open door for abortion if we have the right to control our body.
Hmm. So what do you think is going to happen today? What will be the direction of the Rehnquist Court, the kind of questions asked, and, well, if you have a crystal ball, the result?
Well, I wrote a piece for the American Bar Association Journal about this, and it was an op-ed piece, and then they were looking for somebody to do the other side. They asked the usual conservatives to defend Lanier or to argue the fact that this should be just in the state courts, and they actually had trouble finding somebody, but they did get a woman eventually from the Independent Women's Forum, which is a conservative group of high-profile women to argue that case. So I really don't have a crystal ball on this one. It seems to me very clear-cut that, yes, sexual assault should be included under this statute, since it's been included for so many other kinds of things. But it's anybody's guess. And I think we can tell from the questioning of how they handle the lawyers what might be coming up. And, I mean, what is Clarence Thomas going to do with this case?
Recuse himself?
I doubt it. The interesting thing is that this case could also be applied against President Clinton, you see, because he was governor at the time that he allegedly assaulted Paula Jones. So, it could be a certain amount of trouble for everybody. But it won't be. If it doesn't apply in this case, I just think it will be outrageous that women can't be free from sexual assault from police officers and judges who won't be tried in state court.
Hmm. Now, the judge, though he was originally convicted and sentenced to 25 years and served some time in jail, when the Sixth Circuit court ruled, he was freed. Is that right?
Well, he was freed the next day. He actually served 18 months in jail, and there was a plea bargain on the table that would have, I think he would have only served a year in the plea bargain, but the women and the Justice Department turned it down. So his appeal had been turned down once by the Sixth Circuit when only three of them heard it. And then later on, a year later, they came, the entire Sixth Circuit decided to hear it, and everybody thought that was very strange. The questioning went that day very much pro-Lanier about the fact that this wasn't, that he wasn't doing anything illegal or that it should have been in state court or that it wasn't any different than if he assaulted somebody at a cocktail party when he didn't have his robes on. And the very next day, the circuit voted and was 9-6, and he was out of jail. There's some people who say that it shouldn't be a Supreme Court case are saying that the women could have used the courts to sue for in civil court cases, just as they're doing in the O.J. Simpson case right now. However, before he was indicted, Lanier transferred all of his possessions, his house and all of his money, to his wife. He was an indigent prisoner, and the attorney who represented him before the Sixth Circuit had actually just been appointed by the court. However, he was a former partner of the chief judge of the Sixth Circuit, so he wasn't just your lawyer who's hanging around the courthouse.
He still has a wife.
Well, the last I heard is that they were divorced, but when he came out of court, she was there to meet him. I mean, and she was there every day with their daughters during the trial. So it was really a show divorce. And so the people who were suing are trying to overturn that divorce or show that it was only a matter of convenience. However, I have heard that he was living in Dyersburg at this point with a new girlfriend in a trailer.
Huh. And is he continuing? Is he able to practice as a lawyer? Has he been disbarred?
I believe he's been disbarred. He's not doing anything, as far as I know. He's certainly not a judge anymore. But after he was convicted in trial and before he was sent to jail, he continued to hear cases because the way the law was written, he had to either voluntarily step down. It was only when the state legislature in Tennessee started impeachment proceedings that he was physically removed from handling cases in the court.
One of the issues that the judges are likely to focus on today is a 1945 ruling called Screws versus the United States. Can you explain what that is?
Screws versus the United States was a case that I actually don't know that much about. I mean, it was the case that they used when they brought the trial and talked about it before the Supreme Court, and I believe it had to do with police officers.
And it has to do, I think, with the right not to be assaulted using civil rights statutes requiring that a finding the official deprived his victim of a—I'm just looking at the Washington Post for a little explanation here. It says that Screws versus the United States says using the civil rights statute requires a finding that the official deprived his victim of a right that has been made specific either by the terms of the Constitution or laws of the United States.
Yes, well, it certainly seems that if you're a judge in chambers telling someone that they're going to lose custody of their child unless they open their mouth and take in your penis, you are abusing the power invested in you as a judge.
Well, we will report on what happens today after oral arguments. And you mentioned Paula Jones. That, too, is going before the Supreme Court next week. What do you think of this, rash of sexual harassment, sexual assault cases that are going to the Supreme Court? What does it say about our society and about men in power?
Well, I don't think that men in power are doing it any more than they used to. I just think that women are being empowered and are finding a way to say enough is enough. I mean, this all began publicly with Anita Hill, and I think that these cases are finally wending their way up to the court. Everything takes a long time, it's not just a coincidence that we have Lanier and we have Paula Jones and we have before them Anita Hill and all the other sexual harassment cases. I mean, it speaks well for us. because certainly for women, if certainly men were doing these things a long time and nobody was paying any attention, it was the way things were.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about the Paula Jones case? What will come of it? Many are speculating that the judges will allow discovery to go forward so that the president will be questioned, but that they will let stand a notion that a sitting president should not be sued. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, this is a really complicated question for feminists, and they hate talking about it, but I actually think that it will be too distracting for a president to be dealing with an issue like this, and I hope that he doesn't have to. The trial doesn't go forward while he's a sitting president. However, the evidence looks pretty good. I mean, about Paula Jones's case, she told two of her friends about it sort of immediately afterwards and was obviously visibly shaken up, they said. If it happened people are now beginning to think that the initial skepticism about Paula Jones wasn't correctly placed. If it happened, then there should be some kind of public redress for this.
Frankly, I don't understand the issue that a president can't be sued. Is it the idea that a president can go to criminal court? I mean, if he assaulted someone, but that this, even if this was an assault on Paula Jones, is being tried in a civil court that she is just suing, and that's why? Or could he not also go to court, actually, be criminally tried?
I mean, he'd have to be impeached first, but he can't go to actually court. That's what the issue is, because it's too distracting from the government, the business of government. Whether, you know, to be sued, I mean, that means that somebody could sue the president who was angry because they slipped on a banana peel in front of the White House, if it was allowed in any case.
Let me ask you about the press reaction, both in Paula Jones' case and in the case of Judge Lanier. In Paula Jones' case, we know that the press hardly took it seriously at the beginning, perhaps because there was a real class bias there, as I remember journalists on television talking about her big hair trailer background.
Right.
But what about the press in both cases?
Well, I think that you're absolutely accurate. The press was very skeptical. The press said, just a woman out to get some money, to make a name for herself, to get in the jeans ad. But, you know, women, all kinds of women are susceptible. They don't all look like Anita Hill. Anita Hill was much more believable because she was a law professor, because she comported herself so well, because she was so neatly dressed. Paula Jones does have big hair and doesn't come from an upper-class background. But often women like that are the most vulnerable. They're the ones who don't have any recourse. And so they're the ones who are hit upon the most.
Would you say that the women's movement fell short in this case, why they didn't rally around Paula Jones in the way that they did Anita Hill?
The women's movement often falls short in cases like this, when the person being attacked is one of theirs. I mean, in Paula, what was the women's movement going to do? Rally around Dole, who was going to put them back to the future by putting them back in the kitchen? The feminists just don't want to think about this one. It's a real hard nut. It's their president in a sense rather than the other guy. And yet if he's doing this, we all have this aversion to it, of course, but it's a real sticky wicket, like, oh, Lord, why did one of ours do this?
Well, it seems like a lesson was learned in the case of Senator Packwood, where he abused dozens of women. One of those women, Vice President, I believe it was of NOW, the National Organization for Women, or maybe it was NARAL. But she didn't come forward precisely for that reason, because he was a Republican who supported women.
Right.
And when she learned how many other women he had abused, she was very sorry that she had done that.
Mm-hmm. I know. Yes, it's a difficult nut for women. And the Paula Jones case, I think women are beginning to change. But you also have to look what they did with Norma McCorvey, who was the woman who in Roe versus Wade. They didn't like her either because she wasn't like them, like the white feminist upper class, middle class women who the women's movement is largely made up of. And so this happens all the time, and yet the people who need abortions, who can't go to Puerto Rico or to England or to find a doctor who will do it here in a hospital, or the women who are hit upon by public officials and employers, are often not, people who have a lot of resources. They're often poor. They're often undereducated, and yet the women's movement seems to turn up their nose at them.
In the case of Judge Lanier mm-hmm. and the kind of crimes he committed against women, and women saying they dared not come forward because they were afraid, you know, it was a sort of one-family community mm-hmm. there and mm-hmm. that they would be out of a job, what do you suggest when someone in authority abuses someone, when someone in authority abuses a woman?
Well, it always takes one woman who is brave enough to stand up and say no, and then often other people rally around her. I mean, it is difficult. I would never really advise somebody to take a stand if they were afraid, because this has to come from their own heart. Of course, you know, my belief about life in general is that if you go through life and you never offend anybody, you've never been a very effective person. So I admire the people who take stands, but it's like the women who brought suit against, let's say, the Century Club in New York City when it was not open to women. Those women were not, when it did come around that that women had to be admitted, those women were not made members. They, you know, didn't pass the test, even though they had all the kinds of credentials and social connections and business connections that the Century Club looked for in their members, but they were blackballed. So the people who you know, sue golf clubs for discrimination or judges for assaulting them are often looked upon with disdain in their town, but they do something very good for all women. It's just a difficult, you have to choose to be a martyr, I guess.
Well, Lorraine Dusky, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Lorraine Dusky, author of Still Unequal, The Shameful Truth About Women and Justice in America. It's published by Crown. And I'll leave listeners with this thought on this subject. As I looked at the Paula Jones case and how the press has covered it over the years, for example, Newsweek admitting itself, Evan Thomas, who wrote this week's cover story, says that on a talk show, he called Jones some sleazy woman with big hair coming out of the trailer parks. Well, who needs presidential PR when you've got the press? You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds with the AFL-CIO's response to the Social Security panel's results that came out yesterday. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Yesterday, a 13-member federal panel announced the results of its 2-year-long study into Social Security. Although the panel was split, the majority of members favored what's being called a privatization option. That is, moving Social Security away from a federal-run system that guarantees monthly payments to retirees to a new system, one characterized by individual accounts with Wall Street brokerage houses and mutual fund companies. Trade unions yesterday pledged an all-out fight against the privatization of the Social Security system, although it's important to note, in the case of yesterday's news conference held by the AFL-CIO, that they do not dispute the idea that investing in stocks is a good idea, but that the entire Social Security fund should be invested as opposed to individuals. The headline in today's New York Times says, panel on Social Security urges investing in stocks, but is split over methods. Today, we're going to hear from a few people at that news conference. We're going to begin with Jerry Shea, who is assistant to the president of the AFL-CIO and a member of the Social Security Advisory Panel that released the report yesterday.
I want to clear up a few points about the report that is being issued today. First, the full council report does not in any way represent a consensus on what to do about the long-term solvency questions that are at the forefront of this debate. After 2 years of study and consideration, we did not agree on a plan or even the basis for comparing different proposals. We make no recommendation as a body. Within the report are three statements by groups of individual members on their personal proposals, one of which we are going to cover with you today. But I don't want to obscure the fact that at the beginning of this report are some very important findings of fact and indeed recommendations that do go to a major portion of the Social Security question. Secondly, I want to make clear that our faction, as one of the leading newspapers referred to us over this weekend, consists of six of the 13 members of the Advisory Council. We include the president of the largest private pension program in the country, representatives of 40 million union members and their families, pension experts, and particularly in the person of Bob Ball, a wealth of historic and expert knowledge of the system. Third, we want you to know that our view is that the Advisory Council report does in no way offer three acceptable plans from which policymakers can or should pick and choose. Two of the plans, the so-called privatization proposals, should be rejected on merit from the outset, in our opinion. We should not and need not give currency to false cries that the sky is falling on Social Security. In fact, the plan we submit to you today for consideration, what we call the Maintain Benefits Plan, should be considered, we believe, as the only common sense starting point available in the report for a sober discussion of preserving and protecting what is the most successful family protection program in the history of our country. And Social Security is not only the most successful family economic security program, with 44 million Americans currently receiving benefits of some kind, but since fewer than half of all U.S. workers today are enrolled in private pension plans, Social Security is becoming increasingly important. And today, more than a quarter of retired Americans depend on Social Security for almost all of their income, and a substantial majority get most of their income in retirement from Social Security. The system has just gone through, in the form of this council, a periodic review, and it does need adjustments to create additional revenue over the long term, just as has been the case since this program was begun 60 years ago. The Advisory Council unanimously agreed that, quote, the program can be brought into long-run balance without departing from its basic principles or undermining the economic well-being of future workers and program beneficiaries. Despite this statement, some members of the council want to make radical changes that would not only dismantle the system, but divert large amounts of money to Wall Street. In making our statements today, we do not impugn the motives of our colleagues on the Advisory Council, only their judgment. But we do take issue with the motives of the Wall Street firms that are already funding a public campaign on their behalf. Finally, I point out that as individuals, even those of us who come before you today, do differ in our opinions on some items, some of which are the subject of footnotes in the text or to the text of the report that you have. But despite the diversity of our perspectives, we are united in our commitment to a common sense, mainstream approach to Social Security and in our opposition to the radical restructuring being proposed by some of our colleagues.
Jerry Shea, assistant to the president of the AFL-CIO. We now turn to Gloria Johnson, president of the Coalition of Labor Union Women and vice president of the Electrical Workers Union. She, too, was a member of the Social Security Advisory Panel.
I appreciate the opportunity to be here this afternoon to share my views with you. As I sat through the meetings of the Advisory Council over the past 3 years, I often thought, am I on the moon or am I sitting in this room? The Advisory Council found that our wonderful Social Security system needs a tune-up. And then, 7 of our members decided that the real solution is to send it to the scrap heap. The full Advisory Council decided it didn't want to solve Social Security's problems with a big tax hike on long-suffering middle-income families, but the privatization plans being proposed by some members go the other way. One of them imposes $12 billion a year in new individual taxes for 72 years. The other one raises taxes on workers and employers, $13 billion a year forever. We decided as a full group that benefit levels are about as low as a civilized society can tolerate. And then, 7 members of the council proposed plans that cut benefits an average of 30% or more. In my opinion, these recommendations defy all logic. We know that no program has ever done more to alleviate poverty, protect our children, protect the disabled, protect the elderly, and no such program has ever enjoyed greater public support. The Social Security program functions as a national family protection program. It's fair, it is a sharing program, it is highly efficient, and it is practically universal. So we should abolish it. Middle-income families won't stand still for any more upfront tax increases. So let's slip a big one through the back door. 90% of American voters think we should increase our meager Social Security benefits. So we should cut the benefits below the poverty level. Most workers and their families want little more than a safe pension that they can depend on without too much worry. So we should throw them into the pit and let them scrap with the wolves. If this sounds like a badly flawed approach to you, you have good ears. Well, let me tell you, so do America's working families. And when we get through reading them the fine print, you will hear the screams from Maine to New Mexico. Now, I know that there are some of you in this room who are going to intellectualize over the privatization proposals. America's working families and the organizations represent them aren't going to do that, because we know when we feel someone's hand in our pocket that we are probably getting our pocket picked. And so we will begin today to form a powerful coalition to dispatch this twin-headed monster supported by Wall Street and right-wing think tanks so we can get on with the business of stabilizing Social Security with thoughtfulness and restraint. And this coalition won't be hard to build because individual retirement accounts give everyone something to loathe. Current retirees, the disabled, women, children, future retirees, taxpayers, employers, we all get creamed. Young people, who do you think is going to pay the $6 trillion in new taxes over the next 72 years? Who do you think is going to suffer from the Social Security benefit cuts in future years? Who's going to suddenly discover that it's mama knocking on the front door? Our young people aren't stupid, and they aren't selfish. And we've discovered that they support the concept of Social Security, and they know that these privatization plans have about as much chance of succeeding as they have of seeing a UFO. I think it's a shame that the progressive, unselfish members in society now must mobilize an all-out defense of the most important family protection program we have or have ever had. But my friends, we're going to do just that. And as of now, our elected officials are on notice. Thank you.
Gloria Johnson, president of the Coalition of Labor Union Women. And finally, Edith First, a pension fund lawyer, also a member of the Social Security Advisory Panel.
I want to talk to you for a couple of moments about why I feel privatization is a threat to American women. Despite the fact that most women have gone to work, as everybody knows, most are still continuing to get their benefits through marriage, through their husband's earnings, rather than through their own. And this is expected to continue. As late as 2015, only 20% of women are expected to be earning as much or more than their husbands, and the other 80% are expected to be earning less. The reason this is so important is that survivor benefits, that is, the benefits that are paid to husband or wife when they're widowed, are the higher of what the worker has earned or what the spouse has earned. And if the husband has earned more, then the women are going to do much better if they take as surviving widows rather than as workers. And this is very important because the poorest segment of the elderly population by far, are elderly widows. In fact, we need to be worried about them separately, not to be cutting their benefits. And one of the things that privatization would do is it would take the current structure of Social Security, which provides assured benefits to spouses and survivors as a matter of law, and end that. And there would only be the privatized fund that the worker received, which would have to be divided between husband and wife as they see fit or as the divorce court orders. Now, anybody who's been married 10 years or more gets an assured survivor or spouse benefit. But under the new system, that wouldn't happen at all. People might really be left with nothing. At the time that an employee retires under the privatization proposal, or at least the major one before us, the retiree would get access to the full amount in his or her personal account. That money could be used however he or she wished. For example, my guess is a lot of it would be used to pay debts on consumer credit cards. Some people might take it to Las Vegas. Others might give it to a girlfriend. Others might say, I want this to last my lifetime. But it would be very hard to do that because in order to have it last a lifetime, you must have an annuity. An annuity can be purchased on the private market, but it's expensive, partly because people who buy annuities self-select, and the annuity industry recognizes that they must charge enough to take care of adverse selection. And so they do charge more, and some people looking at this would say, well, why should I spend all this money on an annuity, and I may die next week? Wouldn't it be better for me just to parse it out myself? Well, it probably wouldn't be better for that person. Certainly if he doesn't die next week or next year, certainly wouldn't be better for his or her spouse, who on average will live an extra 6 years. And of course, everything we talk about on averages has extremes. Social Security today assures a pension to the spouse for life, and also for the retiree for life. And so without annuitization, this assurance of lifetime benefits would disappear. I have some other ideas which I think are too complicated for me to go into now, but they're all on this three-page paper that was distributed to you called Privatization of Social Security, A Threat to Women, and I hope that you will all read it. It's not a very long or difficult thing to read.
And that was Edith Fierst, who is a pension fund lawyer, and she was one of a group of people who was at the AFL-CIA CIO News Conference in Washington, D.C. yesterday. You can call the AFL-CIO if you'd like to get a copy of their report. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show on tape cassette, you can order it by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. We'd also like to know what you think about Social Security as we continue to bring you programming on it. Call us at 202-588-0999 and leave your comment at extension 313. That's 202-588-0999, extension 313. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin with help from Errol Maitland, Julie Drizin, our executive producer. Thanks to Don Rush. I'm Amy Goodman for Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!